Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Mr. Frank Gaffney, who actually earned his vacation, unlike our president. And I have the pleasure of being joined today by Claudia Rosette, who is a journalist in residence at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome to the show, Claudia.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Claudia, I wanted to pick your brain on a topic you spend a lot of time taking one for the team, kind of digging into, and that is the UN and how they facilitate a lot of the bad things that Hamas does. Now, the Palestinians have long been a client, more or less, and a, I guess, user of UN services. But they've also managed to, I don't know if they corrupted the UN or if the UN's natural corruption just extended itself to them, but a lot of the funding goes through an agency called UNRWA. Could you tell us a little bit about them and some of what they do to make Hamas functional and facilitate some of the awful things they're doing?
Yeah, I think the corrupting influence has been mutual. But UNRWA dates back to its creation in 1949 as a temporary agency to provide jobs and relief for Palestinian refugees. You'll remember the UN offered two states, one to the Palestinians, one to the Israelis. The Israelis accepted. The Palestinians said no. Israel was then attacked. Palestinian refugees ended up in bad trouble at that point. UNRWA was created to help them with the idea that it would be temporary. Instead, it has turned into this ever-expanding, very strange, very disturbing UN agency, one of the most perverse that the UN has, which is really saying something. And they began with, the numbers with UNRWA vary greatly, which to me is a red flag with the UN agency when the numbers never add up. But by their own account, they had some 750,000 beneficiaries in 1950 when they were set up. This is UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East is the full name. And today they have extended refugee status to, down the generations, they have more than 5 million Palestinian beneficiaries. In other words, in part, UNRWA operates as this massive entitlement program.
So this is like the worst thing that could happen to us if Obama were to take this as the model, right?
Correct. Now, that's just the beginning of what the problem is with this outfit. UNRWA employs mostly Palestinians, and it is one of the biggest employers of, I think it may be the biggest employer of any UN agency. It's certainly way up there. They employ at this point 30,000 Palestinians. They have a small number of international staff, but basically it's staffed and largely run on the ground by Palestinians. So it's an entitlement program to which the U.S. contributes as the biggest single contributor, followed by the European Union. U.S. gives hundreds of millions of dollars every year to this. UNRWA operates in Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, the West Bank, and Gaza. Gaza is a major focal point of what it does. It moved its headquarters there in 1996. These days it splits its headquarters among Gaza, Jerusalem, and Jordan. But Gaza has 12,500 UNRWA employees who are busy funneling your tax dollars and European tax dollars mainly to run a whole range of things. Schools, hospitals, all sorts of counseling, welfare services, lending, they give the cash disbursements in some case. And the further problem, this would be bad enough if Gaza had a reasonable government. Okay, this is a huge welfare program. This does not breed a healthy society or economy. But Gaza is run by a terrorist group, Hamas. So what UNRWA ends up doing is greatly relieving Hamas of the cost and chores of actually running a government. Well, Hamas rules Gaza, serves as the de facto government there. UNRWA provides the household help, basically. That's freeing up Hamas to do what we've just seen it do, what it's been doing for years, to bombard Israel, to, we now have learned, to dig miles of expensive tunnels into Israel for attacks. So you have basically an immense UN welfare agency that is turned into this enormous entitlement program, effectively run on the ground by the Palestinians, which is servicing a terrorist group. So what's the problem with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's many. First, let's at least state that they do some good, all right? They provide some social services. But like you said, they do that in a way that allows Hamas to be free for their core mission, which is pushing the Jews into the sea. And basically, the one thing I find almost comical is the regular discovery that the places that the Hamas terrorists, their headquarters, and put their rockets and shoot, you know, things from tend to be these UNRWA facilities. Now, if they're the only ones providing social services, maybe that's a coincidence, but it really doesn't feel that way to me. It feels like there is almost a collaboration at this point where directly these guys are the face, the polite face of, you know, a terrorist group. And we should probably at some level be looking at them as that.
Well, UNRWA, Hamas has tremendous incentive to use UNRWA facilities, the reason being that UNRWA then gets on the UN stage and expresses outrage, calls for investigation, protests, laments, and it's effectively, it hands Hamas this tremendous megaphone beyond the wildest dreams of most terrorist groups for having the UN itself plead the cause of Hamas.
Without mentioning the fact that they're committing war crimes, Hamas is facilitated by the UN by allowing those weapons to be stored there and by allowing them to shoot rockets from these areas. Those are war crimes, and that somehow never seems to get mentioned in the press conferences about how the horrible Israelis have retaliated by hitting an area that was a source of a terrorist act and a war crime.
Well, the usual pattern or the template they seem to follow for these UN press releases and press conferences and so on is they ritually drop in somewhere a note that there should be a halt to the or an end to the bombardment of to the use of rockets. In other words, there's some sort of ritual thing that implies they never named Hamas, but that should stop.
Like the rockets fire themselves.
The rockets, exactly. The rockets fire themselves, and the rest of the press conference, the large world surrounding text, and the resulting investigation, which we're going to see again now, this kind of thing. That's all about deploring anything that Israel has done in its own defense. So, and remember, UNRWA is largely staffed by Palestinians. The international bureaucrats who run it. Anyone who wants to go in and out of Gaza has to be aware that he better play ball with Hamas, the terrorist group that rules Gaza, or bad things will happen. Apart from the fact that some of them have clear sympathies with Hamas, for instance, the UNRWA spokesman who was filmed by on Al Jazeera Live TV, rather than answering questions. Which, by the way, he doesn't do if he doesn't like the reporter who has written in. He never took the time to answer mine, was filmed weeping on camera for the Palestinians. Now, this is not a neutral agency.
Yeah, well, I can weep for the Palestinians too. However, it's not because of the fact that they are blameless victims. It's due to the fact that, as you mentioned, for the past 60 years, they have systematically refused to join the civilized world, refused to do anything to create for their people a place to be safe and happy, and are facilitated in this in so many ways by the UN. Claudia, it's a disgrace. Greatly appreciate. Like I said, you're taking one for the team in doing this, and continue to eyeball them. We'll continue to try and help get the word out. This has been Claudia Rosette, who is journalist in residence for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Thanks again, Claudia.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there, America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps gunnery sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen from Black Five, and we are joined this segment by Maria Worlau, who is director of the nonprofit Cuba Archive. You can find that at cubaarchive.org. Welcome to the show, Maria.
Hi, nice to be here with you.
Well, I got a question for you. It seems that there is a return almost to the Cold War era jockeying for position in Cuba between us and Russia. I mean, we've had some sort of type covert type operations with USAID and then Putin visiting down there and trying to make friends. Is Cuba back in play with the Castro regime hopefully coming to an end soon?
Well, first of all, I don't agree that the Castro regime is coming to an end. I think there's been a very successful succession of power from Fidel to Raul. Not that it means much, that much is different other than probably some cosmetic reforms that we can discuss if we have time. But Raul was second in command for Castro from 1959 to 2006. Now, the relations with Russia had suffered a lot at the end of the Soviet Union when it collapsed, and it had subsidized Cuba to the tune of many billions of dollars a year. And Fidel Castro was very upset at Russia, at the Soviet Union, for not coming to the rescue, for ending commercial agreements, etc. So the relationship had suffered a lot, and in 2000, Putin had gone to Cuba and had pretty much ended an accord to have a surveillance, electronic surveillance station called Burdis that the Soviets had built. And that was the last straw. There was also conversations about $32 billion in debt that from the former Soviet Union. So the relationship was very distressed. But in 2006, when Raul Castro succeeds Fidel Castro, when Castro, the older brother, gets sick, Raul, who is very pro-Soviet, has been and was the head of the military in Cuba, begins to restore relations with Russia.
Folks, we are talking with Maria Werlau, who is director of the Cuba Archive, about changes between the relations between Cuba and Russia, as well as some initiatives that the U.S. may be trying to, destabilize or get a better handle on what's going on. And I take your point, which you made, that the Castro regime may not be ending, but I'd like to be at least a little hopeful that during, you know, once Fidel dies soon, hopefully, that we can take advantage of that in some way, shape, or form to get a foot in the door. Do you see any possibility of that?
No, I don't. Yeah, not at all. In fact, Raul Castro, who is, by many accounts, a lot more pragmatic than his brother, is as fervently communist or whatever you call that ideology that is still left in Cuba, but definitely intent on remaining in full control and in full power. And the minor economic reforms that have happened, although they have been very significant because Cuba has been a very totalitarian regime, still do not give any political or civil rights, have not restored property rights. I mean, it's very limited and leaves all the discretion to the Communist Party in the hands of the Castro brothers. And Raul is very much attempting to, I think, leave his children in control. I mean, that's pretty obvious to me. And going back to the relationship with Russia and Putin, I think those Cuba watchers who have followed it are not surprised by the fact that Russia recently formally forgave $32 billion in debt from the former Soviet Union to Cuba and have restored agreements in the military arena there to establish bases in Cuba and other things that we don't have time to get into. So I think this is not surprising to at least some of us.
Now Putin's been there. Putin, you mentioned that Cuba may no longer be a pure communist regime. It may just be a totalitarian state. That's more or less the same thing that Putin's Russia is. It's no longer the Soviet Union. It's no longer a pure communist enterprise. It's more of a criminal enterprise run by a thugocracy. So those two seem to have a lot of common ground. Is that where you see them working together, as you mentioned, militarily, economically, and other ways?
Absolutely. And one of the common elements is a hatred to the United States. The Cuban regime, I was talking to a friend the other day, is like, what is left of this ideology? There is nothing. I mean, they've even stopped talking about communism. They don't let the media in Cuba, especially towards the outside world, talk about their regime in communist terms. Yet it's the Communist Party that continues to guide society, and it's a communist constitution. So I do think that Cuba is moving very successfully towards state capitalism, like in Russia and or China. I mean, it's a model that Raul has very effectively imitated and has put in power. So no, I'm not very hopeful at all that there will be any change that benefits the Cuban people or brings any type of freedom.
So they're basically taking the engine of capitalism and the boot on the neck of the people from communism, and like you said, as has been done in Russia, as has been done in China, using that engine to power the regime's continued existence. And it doesn't have to be ideological in nature, because in the end, the power has, you know, devolved to the insiders who are benefiting from that. So if we don't have any way to reach out to a group like that, are efforts like USAID was apparently making to send students in and have them corrupt from within, is that even worth trying? That was a kind of an odd little bit there.
Well, I think that there has been a lot in the media that does not portray those programs correctly, and there's a lot of back and forth from people who participated. We don't have time to get into the role of the Associated Press and their correspondents in Cuba that they have played, and other people that that planted this idea that this is some sort of subversive or covert program. Of course, it's covert in a country where, you know, having a computer is a crime, or, you know, the internet is not allowed. You know, all the media is in state hands. That there's like dozens of state of crimes for, you know, state security crimes in the penal code. So bringing about internet communications, democratic ideas is subversive in a country like Cuba. But I mean, that the commitment of the United States, not only in Cuba but in many countries, is to promote freedom, and I don't think we need to apologize for that.
And I think you make a valid point that anyone who is advocating for that is in difficulty. You know, even our own folks down there at the embassy and whatnot, when they have done some of their, I don't want to call them stunts, but, you know, when they fly the flag, when they do radio broadcasts, when they try to provide the tools of democracy, they get a significant blowback from the Castro regime. So it's a danger for anybody who tries it.
Oh, yes. Well, it's very discretionary and arbitrary. When the regime wants to give a lesson, it will. Like, for example, Alan Gross is in Cuba now, and for years, he's an American who went to Cuba to apparently allow the Jewish community to access the internet and bring some tools for people to communicate with the outside world. And he was put in prison, accused of crimes, and he's being held as a hostage in Cuba.
Well, folks, we've been talking with Maria Werlau, who is director of the Cuba Archive. You can find that at cubaarchive.org. Next up, we'll be talking with Gordon Chang about some interesting developments with Christianity in China. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney doing Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Incredibly, the Obama administration says it will allow Libyan nationals to study in U.S. flight schools and nuclear engineering programs. This comes as Libya is so overrun by jihadists that our embassy there has been closed. The question occurs, just who will be vetting the prospective students so as to ensure terrorists aren't getting American visas? It turns out that Team Obama has recently awarded a $190 million contract for investigating foreigners seeking to enter the United States to a company called U.S. Investigative Services. That would be the same company the Justice Department is suing in federal court for fraudulently claiming to have performed over 600,000 background investigations for government security clearances. Americans are entitled to expect their government to enhance public safety. This administration doesn't. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen from Black 5 sitting in for Frank. We are joined by Gordon Chang, who is a Forbes.com columnist and also blogs at the World Affairs Journal, and who also keeps an eye on Asia. And there's some interesting things going on the religious front in a, I guess, basically non-religious country, or at least at what was a non-religious country of China. The Pope seems to be reaching out to them and trying to open some doors, mend some fences, and do some of that. How's that being received?
Well, Pope Francis, as you mentioned, is trying to open doors with the Communist Party. And so far, the party has not entirely rebuffed him. But we've got to remember that popes, and this goes back a very long time, have tried to establish good relations with Beijing, and they have completely failed. You know, at the same time, the religious authorities in Beijing are trying to create a third branch of Christianity. You know of Catholicism, you know of Protestantism. Now they're trying to create a Chinese Christian theology, which is, of course, going to be atheistic. This is just shows how really unrealistic Beijing is when it comes to Christianity, which is the fastest growing religion in China, especially underground Protestant churches, which have just spread throughout the country, and Beijing is hopeless. It just has no tool to stop it.
So they're making up their own. Interesting. Does this Jesus guy play a major role in this? Is there any relation between this and, you know, so what we would understand as the two more normal branches that you mentioned?
Beijing hasn't said very much about what their Chinese theology is going to be, but they have said that it's going to be something that supports social harmony and economic development. So this is more about gross domestic product than it is about salvation of souls. China has what are the official Chinese churches, which are labeled patriotic and which are really meant to support the Communist Party. But Christians, by and large, have stayed away from them, and they pray in underground churches, both Catholic and Protestant. And that's where the real growth has been. And even we have seen the bishops of the official churches actually support positions that Beijing doesn't like. So China really is in a very difficult position when it comes to Christianity. And so, therefore, they're very afraid of Pope Francis's initiatives, which they realize could just be the thin edge of the wedge.
So, I mean, are they going with a pure opiate of the masses with their new Chinese Christianity? I mean, is that, I could see a play being made there, you know, where they control it, they feed it out, they say, okay, if you need a little something other than just pure communism, here you go, here's a little religion for you if that makes you feel better. Does that seem to be the play?
That is the play, and that has been the play for quite some time. But as, you know, just Beijing is obviously atheistic, is very hostile to religion, and not just Christianity, but also to other forms of religion. But China has become one of the most religious countries in the last last decade or so, as we've seen the spread of religion really go beyond the control of the central authorities. And they're very concerned about that because they are control freaks, after all, and this is the one thing that they can't do. They can't seem to harness religion. And so they try in many different ways, the most recent initiative being this Chinese Christian theology, but it really is doomed to failure.
Is there a response from the people in any way, or is it seen as just, you know, kind of a naked ploy?
Well, this most recent initiative about a Christian Chinese Christian theology is really too new for there to be a reaction. But this is part of a broader narrative of the Communist Party losing the Chinese people. You know, it can coerce the Chinese people. It can force them not to do certain things. But it really can't win hearts and minds anymore. And that really is a problem for them because most people don't believe that a one-party system is appropriate. They don't like the excessive meddling in their lives, whether it's religion or whether it's the number of children they can have. All of these things just rub the Chinese people the wrong way. And so the Communist Party is really no longer what it was in the early years under Mao, which is a driving force in society. It is really trying to hold society back. And that is the most important thing about China today, is that the Chinese people are moving forward and the Communist Party is sort of trailing behind. It can coerce, but it can't convince.
Folks, we're talking with Gordon Chang about some interesting developments. Pope Francis reaching out to China and the Chinese government, and the government itself inventing Chinese Christianity. Now, you mentioned the early days of communism. You know, the Cultural Revolution and some of the things they did early, they weren't just coerced. They were slaughtered into acceptance. And they've also, I guess, in some ways, lost to a form of capitalism, or at least an ability to see something other than the party line as a possibility. They've lost the Chinese people to that. So at this point, you think they're just scrabbling to find something to, you know, entice people to their way of life?
Yeah, I think what they're really trying to do is they realize that, first of all, the Communist Party realizes there's a lot of internal problems that they're now dealing with, and this is the so-called anti-corruption campaigns of Chinese ruler Xi Jinping, which really is a purge. But, you know, when you look at the Communist Party's relations with society, it really means that people have the initiative. And this is true from the economy, from social life to religion. It's just one dominant narrative in China today is that the Chinese people are really racing ahead. And the Communist Party doesn't permit, of course, alternate views on politics, but it's having a hard time because on the internet and in other forums, people are talking about representative governance because the Chinese people, like everybody else around the world, want to have more say in their own lives.
That's always been, to me, the one advantage the West has is as information flows more freely, people get to see what the difference is between their way of life and a free, liberal, Western-style democracy. And, you know, the bottom line is we got it good. We live well. It's an attractive lifestyle. And if you see that as a possibility for yourself, you're much less likely to be the party drone that they got away with making people for so long. Let's talk about freedom of information or the lack of freedom of people's information. Apple has made a decision recently to go ahead and allow personal data to be stored on servers in China. Now, the Chinese are by far, I guess they compete with the Russians to see who can do the most cyber hacking and mischief and worse than mischief online. What are the implications? Why did Apple do it, do you think?
I think Apple decided to store its cloud in China largely because the Chinese government demanded that. It didn't say so in public, but Apple realized that if it was going to have a future in a communist China, that it had to make the officials in Beijing happy. And the officials have been attacking Apple now for more than a year. So Apple felt itself on the defensive, and that's why they are storing encrypted information in China. I don't think that it's going to be as secure as information elsewhere. I mean, the Chinese are pretty good at hacking what we have in the United States. So we got to be clear about security of information, even if it's stored on American servers. But nonetheless, this shows a symbolic caving in of Apple to China. And it's not a good thing because, you know, the Chinese are not going to be appeased by this. They're just going to want more from Apple, and they're going to attack Apple even harder than it has in the past.
I mean, there was a point in time where Google, you know, whose motto was don't be evil, caved into the Chinese government as far as search words and algorithms and some of the things they did to allow stop the Chinese from getting information, Chinese people, and then allow the Chinese government to better control its people. So you think Apple has more or less given the Chinese government more ammunition for steps in that direction?
Yeah, basically what Apple is saying is, look, you know, we want to play by your rules. We'll do whatever you want. And whenever a company does that, they're really in trouble because, you know, Google, as you point out, of course, tried to accommodate the Communist Party when it first entered China. And basically by about 2010, Google realized there was no future in that. So it moved its servers to Hong Kong and did a number of other things. And now Google still has a business in China, but not very much. Baidu, the local search engine, has about a 70-80% share of the search market in China, which Google once had. So, you know, I think the same thing's going to happen with Apple.
I unfortunately believe you are correct, and that's not good news for anybody in China or the rest of the internet because a lot of it gets siphoned off there. Folks, we've been talking with Gordon Chang about some interesting religious and privacy-related issues in China. Thanks, Gordon. Next up, we will be talking with Bing West about the war we won and the peace we lost in Iraq. This is Jim Hansen doing Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the inspector general handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen from Black 5 sitting in for Frank. And we've got the pleasure of being joined by Bing West, who himself has considerable military experience on the ground and also has spent a lot of time researching, writing, and recently embedding and being with our troops. He's got a new book coming out, 1 Million Steps, about what the difference is between the actions of Marine units on the ground and the policies pursued by some of the leadership and how those two don't always match up. That comes out 9 September. I guess the thing that is going on right now is we have a war that we won on the ground in Iraq and a peace that we lost due to policies after the fighting was over. and we're now about to do the same thing in Afghanistan. How does the book you just are finishing up and releasing show the disconnect between the policies of our leadership and what our troops can actually accomplish?
Well, in 1 Million Steps refers to each Marine in a platoon over the course of 7 months took about 1 million steps out in the farm fields where the mines are over the course of his tour. And I try to show that every day they were fighting. And every time the generals and the policymakers would come down, and it was a tough fight, and they would say, you know, we're building this nation, et cetera, et cetera. And the Marines didn't know what they're talking about. On the ground, you're fighting. And this notion that we were building nations, they couldn't understand it. There was such a huge disconnect between those at the top and those at the bottom. It was as though they were on two different planets.
You know, at the point we created a nation, all right, even though nation building may not be the greatest idea in the world, we did create a nation state in the modern sense of the world in Iraq. They had a representative government to whatever extent, you know, with the corruption and et cetera. And like you said, when we left, our leverage over Maliki disappeared and his puppet masters in Tehran became his only guidance, and they were the only ones who were truly influencing him. Consequently, the Shia did pretty well, and everybody else got hammered.
That is correct, Jim. And the only thing I would point out, though, is that in my another book I did called The Strongest Tribe, I tried to point out in that book that the Sunnis came over to The Strongest Tribe, meaning they came over to our side, to the American side. They did not come over to the side of Maliki. And the minute we left entirely, the Sunnis were doomed. So we knew it. I mean, Odierno and Petraeus knew that if that man was left on his own, he would cut out the Sunnis. And the only reason the Sunnis had made a peace was because of us. So the minute we were gone, Maliki turned against them, and you have the situation today.
So if we had maintained, and it didn't have to be a combat presence, if we had maintained at least a large enough presence to be out among the military forces, they may not have reverted to tribal loyalties, or if they did, we might have at least been able to maneuver them, you know, stick and carrot-wise, into doing some smart things. As it turned out, we created a vacuum, and ISIL now has managed to maneuver their way from Syria all the way across, and they're flying the black flag over cities that our troops won in the hard-fought battles that you've been over to share with our troops. It's horrifying to me and sad in so many ways.
Jim, you said everything I could say. And I'll tell you what makes it even sadder is that before we left, and I was talking with the chief sheikh, Sunni, for representing all the Sunnis, and he said, I have one request. And I said, what's that? And I was writing an article. He said, I want Major General John Kelly to stay with us. And I burst out laughing. And he said, why are you laughing? I said, well, I said, you know, you represent the Sunnis, and you are wearing, some of them date back to Muhammad. They're very proud of saying, you know, in my family, there was a relationship. I said, you're one of the favored by Islam. And he said, yes. And I said, and you're asking for a Boston Irish Catholic to be here with you. And he smiled, you know, he got it. And he said, yes. And I knew right then what he was saying. As long as I have an American that I trust, we're okay. And the minute that went away, and now what we're going to have to do, Jim, and it's going to be 5 or 10 years, this president now is back at war, but he can't admit it. So we're doing surgical airstrikes. What he's trying to do is gradually get back to war without admitting he's back at war. And we're going to be bombing these punk terrorists, these Islamists. We're going to have to bomb them for another 5 years or more.
Well, I'm not convinced he wants to go back to war, though.
Well, he doesn't have any choice. The military is fed up with him, bluntly speaking, and they basically are saying, sir, you got to do something. And so every day he's doing something. He's just trying to push away from it, but he's doing it. So we're back at war. And the other thing that's going to happen is we're going to take our CIA and our special forces. I can assure you this is going to happen a little bit at a time. No boots on the ground. They're going to wear slippers, but they're going to be on the ground, and they're going to go back into the Sunni tribes again. And the Sunni, and they know them. We all know each other. It's not like we're strangers to each other. And they're going to say, "Look, you screwed us the last time, and you can't make any promises because we've been watching what President Obama is saying. So how can you help us?" And those special forces and CIA guys are going to have to come up with some. And I know what it is, but no one's going to like hearing it. They're going to have to, they won't say it, but what we're going to do is we're going to say to the Kurds, gradually you're going to get your own state. We're going to say to the Sunni tribes, if you push ISIL out, you're going to have your own state. Now, we won't come right out and say that, but that's exactly what we're going to be doing.
I think it's inevitable. I think the Kurds have already earned theirs and may have, by force of arms, established it at this point. You know, they've got an energy deal with the Turks, and they've shown they're the only ones who have any combat effectiveness. The Sunnis, it gets a little tough, and Obama has said one word over and over and over again, and that's inclusive. He wants an inclusive government, meaning I think he's trying to avoid what you said, but I think you're spot on. There's no way they're going to trust the Shia. There's no way they're going to trust us. And I don't think they should. Why would you? Screw me once, shame on me. Screw me twice. Well, guess what?
Well, it's the same. It's the same with the Kurds, because we've let the Kurds down in the past. This is bad news, not only for this president, but it's bad news for who? For the next president as well. He's painted us into a corner. Not just there, but with the other events. He's backed down too much to Russia. The only way you can deal with Russia is you say, okay, you think you're playing hardball? Our chairman of the Joint Chiefs just made a flight, and he's going to Odessa. He's going to the Ukraine, and we're going to ensure that they have the weapons that they need. And we are going to open up our ports to the export of natural gas. And within 5 to 10 years, Mr. Putin, your economy is going to sag because we're getting into the international game of natural gas. And then he has to say to China, and we are going to send our fleet anytime we want into the South China Sea. We are not conceding that to you. We have to stand up for ourselves.
Well, like you said, I don't think it'll be this president. Hopefully we will elect someone to succeed him who actually remembers that America needs to be the strong horse. Folks, we've been talking with Bing West, a gentleman who has been an action guy and also one of our premier military scholars. His new book, 1 Million Steps, will be out 9 September, talking about every time a Marine plants his foot on the ground during his tour and how out of step those steps are with our policies. Thanks again, Bing.
Thank you, Jim.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.